Iran sees an uptick in labor-related protests coinciding with International Workers' Day. VOA's Persian service tells us how the latest rallies are connected to the nationwide protests for regime change that erupted last September.
After government pushed back the protesters, the protests and demonstrations restarted again.
Plus, a rare online conference brings together dozens of Iranian rights activists and dissidents inside and outside Iran. We ask one of them what comes next.
Probably we are going to be called for a meeting to discuss the articulation of a charter.
And later in the program, what is driving Jordan to consider normalizing relations with Iran? We'll discuss with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Workers across Iran have taken to the streets and walked off the job to protest economic hardships and falling living standards. Information obtained by VOA Persian indicates there was an expanding series of protests and strikes in Iran by members of various trade unions on Sunday and Monday, which marked International Workers' Day. One video posted on Telegram by the Haft-Tapeh Sugarcane Company Workers Syndicate showed what appeared to be pensioners holding a Labor Day protest in the western city of Kermanshah. The demonstrators chanted that they were willing to die but will not accept humiliation. Economically motivated protests have been held frequently in Iran for years. But have they been influenced by the protests that engulfed Iran for months after last September's death in police custody of Mahsa Amini? I put that question to my colleague Ruzbeh Bolhari of VOA Persian.
It's a difficult question, Michael, but I can say before the protests in Iran after Mahsa Amini's death, we had many demonstrations and protests by the pensioners, workers, teachers, nurses. It was a various protests by strike, gathering, or even writing and signing statements.
Yeah, these protests have been going on for years. It's a very common
thing
in Iran.
But in last years, I mean, 3-4 years until now, it was spread by them. And I can say every day or once in 2 days, we had protests in Iran by them. After Mahsa Amini's death, well, everything focused on the protests by the people, not, for example, about the wages or, for example, the conditions at work, insurance, everything. Many of them were forgotten by these groups. But after government pushed back the protesters, for example, killing many of them, or, for example, arresting thousands of people.
Yes, there was a violent crackdown late last year and early this year.
And executed 4 of the protesters who were workers, actually. The protests and demonstrations restarted again, especially from the new year in Iran. Why? Because the government decided and pushed everyone for announcing 27% as a minimum wage. It was nothing.
27, can you explain what does that number mean?
Yes. For example, if you are a worker and you are under the labor law and you are married and you have children, your minimum wage is something like 8 million tomans per month.
And but in dollars, how much is that in dollars?
In dollars, it depends on the exchange rate, actually, but it cannot be more than $200 in a month.
Which is very low.
Yes. Even 1 month, it was less than $170. It was nothing. And the poverty line, recently, worker activist who was member council, which decides about the minimum wage, he said yesterday in International Workers' Day, he said, the poverty line is 21 million tomans. It means $500, something like that, more or less.
A month?
Yes, a month. And there is a very big gap.
There's a big gap because we have a minimum wage that is at $200 a month or below, and that's way below the poverty line, which means that many Iranians seem to be subsisting or surviving on less money than they need to actually, you know, feed themselves and to survive.
They must delete many things. For example, we had some reports that one person talked to a newspaper. She told the reporter that I didn't buy meat for 2 years and I didn't buy chicken from the beginning of the new year. It's a disaster because it had some impacts about the health condition for the people, for the family members and workers. Well, they go for working for another place. But the big problem is we have a lot of reports. For example, people who are cleaning the city, they have not paid for 6 months, 7 months, even 1 year.
Long delays in getting paid.
Yes. How can they live?
That's a very good question. And these are all seemingly very big factors that we are seeing now in these workers' protests that are going on inside Iran. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Ruzbeh Bolhari of VOA's Persian service, great to have you on Flashpoint Iran for the first time.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. It was an honor for me.
Iranian state-approved news agencies say authorities have arrested two dissidents who joined an online conference with 40 other activists inside and outside Iran last month. The reports say the two men were detained days after they joined the event titled Dialogue to Save Iran on April 21st and 22nd. The virtual event gave 23 dissidents inside Iran, some of them already jailed, a rare opportunity to be part of a dialogue with counterparts in the West via the Clubhouse app. One of the participants was Nayera Tohidi, an Iranian-American professor emerita at California State University. I spoke to her by phone Saturday and asked what message she conveyed to the conference.
Well, my main message was to emphasize unity and try to be inclusive and bring into any coalition, especially this one, which was very important to me, since the majority of those who had joined and accepted the invitation are from Iran, based in Iran, very well-known and respected political activists. They represented various stratum in Iranian society, teachers, political activists, human rights activists, journalists, lawyers, women's rights activists, environmentalists, you know, and even religious minorities like Baha'is.
Right. How much did you find that you have in common with all of those people inside Iran?
The commonality is basically around all of us aspiring to go through the process of transition from this current Islamist and repressive government to a secular democracy. So I don't mind that some of them are still kind of religious people, or they call themselves nationalist religious, meaning that they are first Iranian nationalists, but then also they still believe in Islam as their faith, or those who might be rather conservative for my taste. But fortunately, 38% of the 42 people who had this important beginning of dialogue were women. And all of them are for equal rights. All of them are for democracy and secular system. So that is why I emphasize that as long as we all agree on the strategy of nonviolence as much as possible, and also the strategy of inclusivity, respecting Iran's diversity based on gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, religion, class and all these, then we are together despite our different backgrounds.
Given those different backgrounds that you just mentioned and the different kind of ideologies of some of the participants, where would you say that all of you still have work to do in order to resolve disagreements? So where do those main disagreements lie right now?
There are ideological differences, but fortunately, it seems to me that none of these people are very dogmatic or prejudiced toward their ideology. Look, we had even constitutionalist monarchists among us. So as long as we agree that we should work on a charter, that is when we can see what differences are, what are the challenges. But as long as we had agreed to come together, and especially one of the motives of this coming together was the latest statement issued by Mir Hossein Mousavi, who was the former prime minister during Khomeini's time. So actually, this guy was appointed by Khomeini. But he also led the Green Movement.
Yes, and Mir Hossein Mousavi a few months ago called for a real fundamental change inside Iran, and that did trigger some debate.
Exactly.
About the possibility of a referendum. So what do all the participants in this conference think about the idea of a referendum?
I think most of us agree with that, but it depends when and how we can get to that point. Of course, if it is accepted by the Iranian government that is in power right now, then it's even going to be faster and easier. But of course, it should be monitored by impartial international UN-related forces. Otherwise, if you leave it up to this regime, they are going to manipulate it, they are going to cheat. And so we cannot trust the outcome of the referendum. So most of the people who gathered in this dialogue are actually sympathetic toward Mousavi. Some of them are very critical, but now they know that since he has a lot of support in Iran, now that he has completely broken away from this government and believes that we cannot even use the present constitution, of course, and we have to come up with a new constitution, everything. One of the statements that I emphasized in my message was that I expect that Mr. Mousavi and Dr. Zahra Rahnavard, his wife, who is also a very prominent activist, I want to see more clarification about secular position of Mousavi and Zahra Rahnavard.
Right. So after big conferences like this, often there's a question about what comes next. So what do you think is going to happen next among all the participants in this conference? What are you and the others going to do to try to make progress?
Probably we are going to be called for a meeting to discuss the articulation of a charter. And of course, this is going to be done again in collaboration with people inside Iran. And you might know that already three people who joined this conference online from Iran have been arrested. Actually, one of the most active, you know, with groups outside Iran and kind of very seasoned journalists, is Kayvan Samimi. He was arrested even before the conference started. Fortunately, he was, I guess, somehow expecting this might happen, gave a short audio message to the conference. So he was arrested already, but then not only two other people were arrested, but also those who are already in prison and sent their messages from inside the prison to the conference, a couple of them already have been notified that their terms of imprisonment is going to increase. So that's another repercussion. against their freedom. For example, Narges Mohammadi. Narges Mohammadi now has been told that you did something that you were not supposed to do. You send message to this conference by anti-revolutionaries, anti-Iran people and all that, that they use all the rhetoric, so you are going to be punished further.
Well, this is definitely something that we want to follow to see how all of those activists who are inside Iran are being treated by the authorities. Naira Tohidi, Professor Emerita and former chair of the Gender and Women's Studies Department and founding director of the Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies Program at California State University, Northridge, joining us on the phone from Porter Ranch, California. Thank you for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for the opportunity.
VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Could Jordan be the next Arab nation to start reconciling with Iran after Saudi Arabia began doing so in March? Jordan withdrew its ambassador from Tehran in 2018 to protest what it said was Iran's destabilizing interference in Arab affairs. But Amman said its foreign minister had a positive phone call with his Iranian counterpart on April 20th and agreed to meet as soon as possible. Iran said its top diplomat expressed readiness to expand cooperation with Jordan. For more on why they might want to reconcile, I spoke by phone on Friday with analyst Jonathan Shanzer of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Here's how I would start to unpack this. The Iranians have been steadily eroding the deterrence of Arab states in the Middle East. I think they've also been steadily eroding the confidence of these countries. It doesn't help that the United States appears to be losing ground vis-a-vis China and also appears to be still trying to woo the Iranians back into a nuclear deal that would be a huge boost for Iran's ability to create mayhem around the region. And the fact that Israel, which is the primary check on the Iranians, appears to be going through its own domestic tumult right now, doesn't make anything any easier for a lot of these weaker states. And so what we've been watching in recent weeks and months is that the Iranians have been trying to slowly but surely peel away a number of Arab states from the U.S.-led coalition in the region. Jordan appears to be the most recent of them. I think, you know, to put things in perspective, a conversation between two foreign ministers does not mean that Jordan has defected from the U.S.-led coalition in the region, but it is a sign that the Jordanians are wavering. It's a sign that they are not impervious to the news that they're watching around the region as the Saudis make nice with the Iranians, as the Emiratis make nice with the Iranians, as the Assad regime, which is a client of the Iranians, is now broadly welcomed in the Arab world. In other words, it does appear that Iran is surging and Jordan, from what one can tell, they're hedging and they want to make sure that they're not left out in the cold.
Well, you mentioned just now how the U.S. appears to be encouraging Iran to grow its influence by pursuing policies that, in your view, weaken the U.S. role in the region by trying to revive a nuclear deal. I mean, the Biden administration thinks that a new nuclear deal would help things, and it also welcomed the recent normalization moves between Saudi Arabia and Iran, saying that it welcomes any bid to reduce tension in the region. So why wouldn't a Jordan-Iran normalization also be in the U.S. interest?
I think really it comes down to the question of whether Iran is truly willing to reduce tensions in the region or whether it's just simply making a play to peel away some of these allies of the United States from what has consistently and traditionally been an anti-Iran bloc. And so that, I think, is the question that remains to be seen. I believe that the agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, for example, was really largely about Yemen. I think both sides had, come to the conclusion that the ongoing civil war and the proxies that they were supporting, and perhaps some of the damage that they were incurring, collateral damage or otherwise, was just simply not worth it. And so the two sides agreed under Chinese auspices to lower the temperature and to potentially halt attacks on one another or on one another's proxies. With Jordan, it's a bit of a different story. There is no open hostility. Now, of course, the Jordanians have been feeling the pinch from the Iranians, both in terms of Shiite militias in the north, IRGC activity in the south and the Red Sea. In the north, of course, this is in Syria. There's also questions, I think, swirling inside Jordan about the extent to which the Iran-backed axis, particularly Hezbollah and Syria, whether they're behind the flood of Captagon caplets that have been coming in to Jordan.
And can you explain for our listeners what Captagon is?
Yeah, Captagon is it's an addictive recreational drug, very popular in the Gulf. And for many years, the Jordanians were unhappy because Jordan was serving as kind of a way station for these drugs on their way to the Gulf, where each pill would fetch somewhere in the vicinity of $20 a pop. There has been a recent decision on the part of the producers of Captagon, primarily in Syria, that they are going to sell them in Jordan as well. And the sort of budgetary constraints in Jordan are significant. They will not get $20 a pill, but they're getting five, give or take. And that is apparently appealing enough to Jordanian youth. And so there is now suddenly a growing drug problem in Jordan as well that tracks back to Iran.
Well, I was going to ask you, how is Iran connected to that problem?
This is a huge source of funding for the Assad regime in particular, Shiite militias that operate within Syria, purportedly Hezbollah as well. Now, whether money flows back to Tehran's coffers, that's something that I really can't speak to. But the overall constellation of actors that are sort of acting on behalf of Iran, they are key players in the Captagon trade. And so it's for this reason that Iran is seen as, again, one of the destabilizing factors for Jordan. Jordan, of course, has lots of other problems on its hands, political problems, economic problems, demographic problems. All of these things are not easy to solve. But when you also see Shiite militias operating on the Syrian border, you see the IRGC in the Red Sea, and you see Captagon flooding across your border, these are additional problems that they don't need, and they all track back to Iran in some shape or form.
You know, looking ahead, how do you think an Iran-Jordan normalization might unfold? And how do you think the U.S. and Israel would react to that?
Look, Jordan is a weak state, and it would rather not have antagonism with the Iranians. So normalization might just be an agreement to leave each other alone, or more specifically, that the Iranians would leave Jordan alone and that they would just, you know, increase diplomatic contact. The thing that bothers me right now more than anything else, as I see this, you know, sort of flirtation going on between the Jordanians and the Iranians, is that the Jordanians have increasingly been hostile to the Israelis. We've seen really an uptick in fairly hostile rhetoric coming out of Jordan. Now, the coordination between Jordan and Israel remains strong, as we understand it, security cooperation, and the Israelis provide water and gas and a bunch of other things. But every Ramadan, every year, we see heightened tensions. They're not healthy for the relationship. And we're also now hearing that Hamas is, let's just say, more welcome in Jordan than it has been. Some leaders have passed through the country and they've been engaging with the Jordanian leadership. If there's any kind of cooperation in this regard, I would say that it's a major step backward for the overall architecture of normalization and stabilization of the Middle East.
Well, let's keep an eye on that. Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, speaking to us from here in Washington, D.C. Great to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's all for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and please join the team next week for another Flashpoint Iran.